what it means to set up a company as a legal entity. And I thought I would just run through like the five common choices that people often choose as kind of their business model for their company. Now, I'm not a financial advisor, so it's all going to be quite base level information. And I always recommend that, you know, take this information and then look into it more yourself, or look up companies online. So if you find a theatre company, you know, you can go on HMRC on Companies House. You can search their name and it will tell you what they are. So it will tell you if they're limited by shares, limited by guarantee. And you can always reach out to these companies and ask them why they chose their model. And I would hope they'd answer everyone. But let me just talk through the kind of five common business models that people choose. So one business model you can choose, it's called limited by shares. And what this basically means is you set up your company and you exist as a director of this company. So you're in charge, you run this company. However, you can allow people to buy shares in your business. And this is like what Theatreland calls like the commercial model, because basically it allows you to almost get an investor to give you money, and in return they receive, you know, 5%, 10% of your business, very similar to Dragon's Den is always the example I like to give. And basically that person who invests in your company, they become a shareholder. So it means that they are responsible for whatever percentage of the company they take on. And it also means that they are responsible for that percentage of debt as well. So if the company ever did go into debt, it means that you, as an individual who originally owned 100% as a shareholder, you would then only be obliged to cover your percentage of debt, whereas the shareholder would be obliged to cover their percentage of debt. So there's like a more sharing of responsibility. And like I say, the people that I know who run this business model are people that, you know, kind of create these big commercial shows and they want to keep growing and growing. And so this model like really lends to allowing people to invest in your company and they get something back from it, and vice versa. And then another business model is, it's called limited by guarantee, which is actually what my company is registered under. So limited by guarantee is usually a company that operates on a non-profit status. So basically, whatever profit you would turn over on the show, it would be expected that that profit would go to fund your next project, or it would go to fund some kind of, you know, community outreach or something that keeps your business going, rather than you as directors just like paying yourselves extra money because you've made profit. And so the status of this company is slightly different with shares. So when you decide to set up this company as a director, you become a director of the company, but you also become a guarantor for the company, which is very similar to if you've been in a situation in terms of housing where, like when you studied, you needed a guarantor to look after your house. It basically means if I, as Sam, cannot pay my rent, then my guarantor is legally obliged to pay my rent. And what you agree to when you sign up as a guarantor for your company is limited by guarantee, is you write down on your form a percentage of money that you guarantee you will pay if the company ever requires legal action and you know it owes money to people, etc. And quite often, for example, myself, you can put down as little as a pound, meaning that if any bad thing happened legally, I am only obliged to pay a pound towards the cost of the business if things were to go wrong. You know, and a friend of mine, years and years ago, when he was trying to upscale his company, he took a big financial risk on a show. His company didn't make back the money that they'd aimed to make back, and therefore his company went into liquidation. But what it meant was that he as an individual didn't run the financial risk. He didn't suffer as an individual, his company suffered. And so that's why a lot of people see limited as guarantee as quite a safe model in that regard. And it's also, from what I know, now that they've cancelled the CIO model, is it's also the only model that you can kind of start with that will allow you to later transition into a charity status if you so seek, which I'll talk a bit more about in a minute. Because basically, like, charities operate a very similar model to limited by guarantee in terms of how, when you appoint people, they act as guarantors. And so there is a way of which you can transition down the line if you so wished. So yeah, that's the second model that you could go for. A third one, which I know people have done, is you can also register as a CIC company, which is called a community interest company. And basically, it's in the name, this company is set up for the benefit of community, and you have to operate under CIC legislation in order to carry out what you do as a business or as a theatre company. I'm not quite sure what the breakdown of the CIC legislation is, but it's all online to read if that is something that you're interested in. And yeah, what I do know is a CIC company is, it's more about investing all of your kind of profits into community work rather than, again, trying to reek in private profit motives. So for example, with each of your businesses, very much like being a freelancer, at the end of the tax year, you have to file your company accounts. But with a CIC model, not only do you file your company accounts, but you also have to file your engagement report, which is I'm not quite sure what it consists of again, but you basically have to demonstrate all of the activity that you have done to fit in with their legislation that you agreed you would meet when you set up your company. So it's a model that like a few youth theatres I know have, because obviously it's all community-based work. So yeah, that's something you might be interested in as well. And then the fourth model, which some people do, is called a partnership. Now, this is quite similar to a company limited by shares, but basically, when running a partnership, depending on how many people decide to be partners in the company. So for instance, if it was myself and another person, by stating that we would be a director of this partnership, we take equal responsibility of the company. And that's for like running the company, for debts, for accounts, for everything. So the reason why it's different to limited by shares is that limited by shares, people can just take whatever percentage they like. Whereas in a partnership, as soon as you register as a partner, you have equal responsibility to all other partners. And lots of people like to do this because when you do limited by shares, it's quite often that when the business grows, people would like to appoint like a board of trustees who overlook your business and you know, you pitch ideas to and they decide whether that will happen or not, basically. Which is similar to a charity, and I'll explain that in a minute. But with a partnership, you wouldn't appoint a board of trustees. It would literally be, you are the partners, you run the business. Between you, you make the decisions on what happens and what work you do. It's a way of like having equal responsibility with anyone that invests in your company. And then there's the fifth model, which is the charity model. So a charity model is basically like you act as directors of the company, Again, obviously, it's a non-profit organization. But in order to run a charity, the charity is run by a board of trustees. And that board of trustees act as your guarantors, as if you would act as a guarantor if you were a limited by guarantee company. But instead, in a charity's case, there's a board of trustees who are actually at the head of the company, and they act as the guarantors, and they basically overlook all dealings with the company, and they have the final say. They also have the legal right to get rid of you as a director if they no longer want you, and they can appoint someone else. So running a charity, you don't have control as a director as such. You can lose control. And it's a lot more administrative. So in order to set up a charity, you have to undergo meetings with your board of trustees once you appoint them. And you have to minute all of these meetings that discuss what you want your charity to be, what work you want to do, what your aims are. And you write and you document all of these minutes. And I think it's two meetings you have to do minimal, alongside a written application to become a charity. And normally it takes 6 months for all of this to be processed. So it's quite a rigorous application. And there are financial advisors out there who would offer to host all of your meetings, and they would offer to help do your application, because, you know, there can be quite easy to slip up on something like that, because unless you really address how your company is undergoing charitable aims, then there is, you know, there's not a justified reason why you should be a charity. But I do think, like, we once got quoted something like £500, I think it was, for someone to come in and lead like two or three meetings and then help do the application form. So I would highly recommend trying to reach out to companies that have become charities and asking for their help, because it is quite extortionate amount of money, especially when you've got no investment in your company when you're beginning. But a lot of reasons why people are looking to become charities now as theatre companies is because it opens a lot of access to more funding pools, which you might already be aware of. So as a company limited by guarantee, you know, our kind of access to funding pools is like Arts Council funding, or it's commissions from the theatre and that kind of thing. Whereas when you are a charity, you can access community grants up and down the UK. You can apply for like the Esme Fairbairn Foundation. You can apply to all kinds of revenues of funding that's out there. And you'll find, if you look up most theatres that are charities, you'll probably find on their website towards the bottom somewhere lots of like logos of different funding pools that they've managed to apply to. And so there's like a real, there does seem to be a lot of theatre companies now that are adopting that model, because I suppose in the long run it means that you gain more access to funding and can build and expand your company and your work. Yes, so that's kind of the five business models that a lot of theatre companies choose. Now, as I say, like, I'm not a financial advisor, so as much as I've said is probably as much as I know, but I'm more than willing to happy to answer questions on anything that you have in regards to that, or why someone might choose to do that. From a personal point of view, I can give my personal opinion, but from a financial point of view, I'd really just recommend reaching out to companies that operate in these models, or people that offer financial advice throughout all the webinars that are going on at the minute. So I think what we'll do then is, I think let's just open the room up, because I suppose there's going to be lots of questions on all kinds of elements of running a company, from programming to being a legal entity or more. So I think the best way to do it is if you kind of raise your hand, I'll then just call out the name, and then if you unmute yourself and ask the question, and we'll just go from there and fire away until everyone's run out of questions to ask, really. Ollie Savage.
Hi. That was really interesting. Thank you so much. I this might be a bit of an annoying question, but it's just a bit more detail about what you were just talking through. So I run a company that's set up as a community interest company at the moment, and we have been thinking about moving towards being a charity for a while. Obviously something that we're concerned about is what you just were talking about in terms of like the loss of power and like basically putting the responsibility in the hands of other people. I was wondering if you could maybe talk to like, is that the practicalities of that? Because obviously a lot of theatres in London are set up as charities. So I'm wondering really how early stage organisations can maintain that kind of decision-making power, or if indeed they can't at all, while still getting the kind of financial tax breaks and access to funding pools that charities can have.
Yeah, sure. I had a meeting with Joe Scallard a while ago, who's the financial director for the new Diorama. And, you know, she was saying ultimately, like, you've, as a director of a company, you've just got to choose three people which you entrust to support you in your work. And she said, like, really look for people that not only will support you artistically, but she was like, you know, if you have a friend or you know of someone close to you that is good with accounts or something, who has a passion for theatre, then it's a way that you can actually build your board of trustees to help you as an artist. So if you did have an accountant on board who had a love for theatre, then you always have someone that will question your decisions on, yeah, but we should be spending that much money when we might have to pay a certain amount on our tax return, which is coming up in 3 months. And there's a lot of bookkeeping that you need to do as a charity as well. So, you know, her advice was to, as a director, put in charge people that you trust, and also to make sure they're varied in skill. So it's not just your three best friends who are theatre makers who are just going to give you the thumbs up for everything. And then when it comes down to the hard stuff and the finances have gone a bit wrong, that there's no one there with expertise who can help you, kind of thing.
And so is kind of within that what you're saying, that in practice, which is something that I think we've landed on, but I'm not really sure about, in practice, if you're putting on the board of trustees people who you trust, the problem of potentially losing power is not non-existent, but like significantly lessened. It's a kind of a good faith thing.
It's definitely a good faith thing, and I think that's the difference between a theatre company and a theatre. I think in the theatre setting, they do it because a lot of councils invest in them, and they do have to like appeal to the councils as well, because councils would give them money to achieve certain things. Whereas as a theatre company, it ultimately is good faith in people that you believe will keep you in charge and keep running your business. Yeah,
right. Awesome. Thank you so much.
No worries. Next question. Try and search for some more hands. Sorry, a question has just come through on the chat. Let me just answer that quickly. If you're setting up a charity, how many board members do you need? So you need a minimum of 3 board members to set up a charity. It's up to you if you'd like to expand upon that. But a minimum of 3 board members. I don't seem to be seeing people's videos. Does someone want to send through another question in the chat, please? Great. Monica Cox has just said, how do you go about choosing a mission statement? Yeah, great question. I've actually been helping a friend of mine who's setting up a company at the moment go about their mission statement. And I think it's a really difficult thing, because I think quite often they can all sound the same. And I think like my biggest advice is like, you've really got to think about the work you want to do and the audience that you're going to. I think, and thinking about your audience is something that can really like benefit you in terms of what your mission statement is and then how you go about bringing that audience in. For example, with Chalkline, we're a working class theatre company. We aim to deliver working class stories, and our mission statement then became very easy to write because we knew who our audience was. Whereas I think sometimes when you're setting out, it can be quite difficult to know what your mission statement is if you don't quite know who you're making your shows for. And obviously that's very easy to say, like, you know, there's no obligation for you to know who your show's for at first. Sometimes you just want to create. But I would just say, in terms of your mission statement, just really think about who your audience are, what you want to say. And I think it will become a lot easier to write. And I think also read it out loud and read it to your friends. And if your friends turn around to you and they say, I don't know what you're, it's a bit too flowery, or I think you've got to make it really personable, because when you're applying for funding, you're applying for all these opportunities. Theatres don't want to read a million people saying we are innovative, fun, bubbly. You know, we just don't understand who you are and what your work is. So I just think really like narrowing it down to one thing rather than trying to be quite artsy with it is really important. Next question. What's the best way to find a good keeper and accountant? Good question. They can be really expensive. There's a few websites. So I think Equity and stuff can point you towards accountants and bookkeepers. I was lucky to find an accountant through Twitter, actually. I use someone at the moment who works for HR and finance at the Yard, and she does freelance outside of that. I think it's talking to places like Equity, or I would recommend looking up theatres and just seeing who runs the HR and finance and seeing if they do freelance work. And what I would recommend, which we've done, is the first time. So say until you start operating at a point where you need like a bookkeeper to manage your accounts full time, is to get an accountant that will show you how to publish your own micro entity accounts. So you're only paying them to do the first bulk of work for your first year. So until you start turning over a huge sum of money and a huge sum of profit, I would make sure that when you invest in your first accountant, that you actually get them to show you what they're doing, because a lot of it you can do yourself, and it will save you a lot of money in the years to come, until obviously you start growing into a large organization dealing with large sums of money, because micro entity accounts are quite straightforward to do as soon as someone shows you. That would be my advice, and I hope that would cut down a lot of costs for people in the future as well. The next question is, why did you choose your particular model? My honest answer is I was recommended it. I asked a lot of people, I asked around, and the thing that really appealed to me was being able to run an organization where I was only responsible for a very, very small sum of money if the money ever got out of hand. And also, like, we've always talked about the prospect of becoming a charity, which is, you know, something that until you're sure that your business is going to work, is something that we weren't comfortable to jump into right away. And so being a company limited by guarantee still keeps that option open for us in the future. That's why we chose that particular business model. Another question in from Adam says, in a charity model, why would people take the risk of losing control and being rid of as a director? Is the access to the grants the only benefit worth that risk? Yeah, I mean, good question. I think ultimately those that do choose to run on the charity model is because they do have charitable reasons as well. Like, I think the worst piece of advice someone could give you is just become a charity so that you can get hold of more grants and stuff. Ultimately, like, people that do convert to charities, you know, for example, someone that recently did it is Wildcard Theatre, if you've heard of them, and they do a lot of work that talks about mental health, and they do a lot of support for artists. And so their whole theatre company is built around on that premise and going out and helping people. So I think the reason people take the risk is because they want to undergo charitable things, and that's why they take the risk, because ultimately, as long as the charity is still going, it doesn't really matter if they're a director or not, if that's their purpose, if you know what I mean. Would be my answer to that. Like, we had a meeting with the Pleasants a while ago. We talked about it, and they really prodded us and said, "Yeah, but why do you want to be a charity? Because there's a, you know, it is for charitable reasons, and there is stuff that you have to do, and you do lose control. So if your company just wants to make theatre shows, it's not a model that will actually suit you. That there's got to be more to it than just wanting to make the shows." The next question in: how did you fund your Edinburgh Fringe shows without ACE or commission? Great question. The answer is a lot of stress and a lot of strain. Our first show that we took, we managed to raise all of our funding through, we did online crowdfunding, and just begged everyone we knew to share it or to donate to us. We did fundraisers from things such as bingo nights to open mic nights to one company I work with even managed to do bag packing in a supermarket, and you'd be surprised how much money managed to come out of that. And then there was just a financial understanding between all of us, which is the harsh reality of companies starting out at the fringe, is that we could only promise to pay people a certain amount of money once we got our box office to come in. And unfortunately, you know, at the time, that really restricts access to the fringe, and it's something I wouldn't recommend doing myself anymore upon reflection, like 3 years later. But we were very fortunate that even though we made that agreement, because we all worked so hard to fundraise beforehand, we didn't actually need to rely on box office in the end. But I think it's just, another great one is sponsorship, actually. Reaching out to local businesses in your area. So for example, I managed to get sponsored by our local shopping centre that would just, like, you know, give you £100, which to them it isn't very much at all. Whereas to you, once you get 10 or so places doing that, it really adds up. And in return, we would simply just offer them free marketing. So their logo would go on our flyers, their logo would go on our posters and our programs. We'd, you know, put them on our website, all that kind of stuff. And I would say, like, when you approach people for sponsorship, just have that kind of ready to go. And they love numbers. So if you know you're printing 10,000 flyers, tell them your logo will be on 10,000 flyers. Because £100 to get your logo on 10,000 flyers for them is absolutely nothing. So that would be my biggest advice. But it is really difficult. And it is a question that gets asked all the time. My honest answer is you just really have to graft without ACE funding, especially when you're starting out. And then I always say, like, you discover when you get to the fringe whether or not it's something that you want to do again or not. But I just think, crowdfunding, fundraising in person, and sponsorship were the three big things that we managed to do. The next question, Justin, when transitioning from profit share into wanting to pay actors and creatives, is there a format for writing contracts and the legal things I need to be aware of, please? Yes, great question, Elizabeth. One thing that I was never told, unfortunately, is that obviously, like, when you become a legal entity, you are a business and that business is liable as an employer. And I think that's really important to emphasize for anyone that's thinking about, like, setting up a theatre company. Is you then become employers under this company, and contracts are really important. So my friends who run a theatre company, like, within their contract, they didn't state anything to do with, like, an unseen pandemic, and now they've had to fork out lots of money to their actors that were meant to be doing a tour and stuff. And I'm sure loads of you have heard of these stories, or maybe even been in them yourself. But in terms of contracts, we contacted producers and originally, and we contacted like Stage One. Stage One are really good, if you've heard of Stage One. Stage One are basically a big hub for producers. And we contacted places like that are out there to support producers and support theatre makers, and asked them if they had any templates or any guidelines. Also, like, Equity will be a good help as well with contracts. And Equity even have, like, set contracts for certain fringe rates as well that you can look up. And then basically what we've done over time is, depending on the project, we've just adapted and changed that contract and kept it fresh and new every time. And to be open with you all, like, the first contract we did, like, we set dates in there that everyone would have to rehearse. And then when we asked people if they would do, like, an extra day, some people said no, and they had every right to say no, and there was nothing we could do about it. So I think it's just small things like that about making sure your contract can reflect, like, a slight degree of flexibility. Like, even small things like making sure you put in there that your actors will help set the stage if they're doing, like, a really quick turnaround at the fringe and stuff like that. But I think, you know, all the templates and stuff, I would reach out to the places that I mentioned, and then I think it's just up to you to slowly realize what worked and what didn't, and then adapt your contracts as you move forward. That'd be my advice there. Someone is in the waiting room. I don't actually have the power to let anyone in. If Sue's listening, I'm sure she'll let someone in. How do you commission a writer without having the money readily available and no guarantee to go through ACE funding? I mean, ultimately, it that would be the writer's choice, would be my opinion. If they can afford to work with you and do a play without being paid, then you know, some people will. But I unless you can come to an agreement that they do not start writing that play and tell you until you've managed to get the funding. You know, for example, what we did once is we tend to pay people in, like, two bulks. So if it's a writer, we'll pay them we'll pay them half of their money up front to write the play, and then when the play is then written, we'll give them the rest of the money afterwards, obviously depending on their circumstances, if that's achievable. And like I say, that's an agreement that you need to go through between you and the writer. Sometimes we've the writer can't do that, so we'll pay the writer up front, and well you just, like, we find that money through, again, like, a small, like, getting small commissions or like, you know, sometimes you might have to do, like, small fundraisers or small events, or maybe you kindly get, like, a theater to let you host a couple of scratch nights for free, and then they might give you some percentage of the box office. I think, again, like, it's really hard to get anyone to work without the money. So it's just being intelligent and innovative in the way that you do fundraise. And the reason that sometimes we've been fortunate to be able to pay a writer in at a bit, like once they start the draft and then once they finish the draft, is because that would, in that time frame, that helped us to get the cash flow in order to do so. And they were in a position where that was manageable for them. Whereas obviously if they weren't, then that wouldn't have happened. So I think sometimes also being open and honest about where you're at as a company and being realistic of when you can get the money, that can really help in conversations with artists. But again, like money is the biggest problem with engaging with people and making it fair and accessible for everyone. But you know that there's no reason why you can't think of like events that will raise money or try and do stuff that's cost effective. Like I said, like small fundraising events and stuff. You'll be surprised, hopefully, at how generous some people will be to give you some free space to run an event or something. Any advice for starting off pre-funding / grants? Yeah, I think like we're really fortunate to be, well, we were really fortunate, and I hope we will still be fortunate to be in a time coming out of this pandemic where lots of theatres have launched emerging artist programs and stuff like that. And that's where we started. We applied for emerging artist stuff. So we applied for the one at the New Diorama. I know places like Cannes and People's Theatre and London-based stuff do them. And I know there's work going on in the north of England that does a lot of kind of artist opportunities and stuff. And we just kind of kept applying and applying for all of these things that would help us to make connections. And even though we weren't putting out work, it still gave us the opportunity to grow as a company. And then through that, you know, we're just then seeking advice from people on how, you know, you can start writing an Arts Council funding bid. So like through Chalkline, we do free workshops in how to write an under 15K grant. And we will be launching stuff hopefully in the future, depending on funding. It is hard without any advice. So I would just really like look out for any opportunity that teaches you about funding grants and stuff. But in terms of, yeah, starting off, we just kind of did it small. So we started off by doing like two shows in a pub theater where they didn't charge us a higher rate and they just took money from our box office. So as long as like we could pay ourselves, or like, you know, some of us just decided to do it because we loved it, and put on like two small performances. And then my biggest advice is every time you decide to do something small, like that is your opportunity to get people in to watch your work. And from that, opportunities grow. We would email loads of venues. If we were happy enough, we'd email press and start getting quotes about our work. My biggest advice would be to start off small and to do stuff that can be achievable. Like if you could do a two-person play for two nights in a pub that didn't want a guarantee up front, then with time and effort you could fundraise the money to do that, and then hopefully off the back of that you might then get programmed somewhere and then you can start building. But it's really hard. I think that the biggest thing is to start small and just seize every opportunity you get, because ultimately the more exposure you present yourself, like right now lots of people are doing like play readings and and stuff online and stuff like that to kind of get themselves out there and to stay active as companies. And through that, I imagine they're meeting like loads of artists. And one day, one of those playwrights might turn around and say, oh, I've got a bit of money in this play. Do you want to stage it? So I think it's just really about building relationships and doing small projects to build those relationships. And then over time, it just, well, you know, hopefully it just starts to grow and grow. How did you fund your first show with the company? We were actually very lucky. So I'm from Luton, and in Luton they used to do an outdoor festival every year, and they launched a kind of homegrown artist like commissioning pool, and I managed to get one of the commissions. And from that, like, I was told that I needed a company name, and then that's where my company began. So that was very, very fortunate circumstance for me. But the show after that was the Edinburgh Fringe, which is where it then came down to like fundraising online, crowdfunding, events, sponsorship, and that kind of stuff. And that kept going until we started to put in Arts Council bids. And I think like, an important thing to stress is like, if you don't have the finances to do something, then don't run the risk of committing to the project, because that can be really scary when you've agreed to pay a load of people and you're not actually quite sure whether your funding is going to come in or not, and no one can rely on people turning up to shows indefinitely. So yeah, I think just like always making sure you have enough money to do what you're doing is something to really bear in mind. At the very start of making a theatre company, what is the very first thing you need to do? So you've recruited the people you want to work with. What next? Register as a company, apply for funding. What's the order you need to follow? Or is there no hard and fast rule? Yeah, great question. So my biggest advice would be to not stress about registering as a company straight away, because, well, one, it costs. So for example, like to be limited by guarantee, there is an application form you have to do and it costs £41 to submit it. And then once you're accepted every year, you have to pay to file your confirmation statement, which is another £15. And then you'll probably have to pay for an accountant to help do your accounts and then submit that, and then you might have to pay tax. So I would recommend, like, if it's a group of you that want to start out and make work, I think you can operate under a name without being a legal entity. I mean, being a legal entity, you know, gives you the rights and domain over that name. So, you know, you own that business, you own that name, nobody else can use it. But like a friend of mine who runs a theatre company called Lots Watch, which you might have heard of, when they first started out, for years they weren't registered as a business. They just did all of their money through a separate bank account. So I wouldn't say registering as a company is a first step. I think that's something that when you start to grow as a company, it is to consider. Unless obviously you're completely set on this is my life passion and this is what I want to do. But my biggest advice would be not to stress over becoming a company until you're happy creating work together. Like the initial step I would do is responsibilities. So who's actually going to do what in that company? And that's inside and outside the room. Are you all going to direct? Who's the writer? Who's the producer? Are you all actors? Will you then need to bring a producer into projects because you don't want to produce? Who's going to look out for funding opportunities? Who's going to contact press? Who's going to answer all of our emails every day? And it's those responsibilities to really go for first. Like, how like delegating control to people, because I think without people, like without someone in your company doing each of these elements, at times you can just find yourself going, oh, why does it seem like there's so much to do, and it all gets really confusing. Whereas if someone is always looking for funding opportunities, or someone is always doing something and feeding back to you, I think that will really help you grow as a company. So setting out those responsibilities, and then just small things like setting up social media profiles, because they're free, and that's where you can build followers, build an audience, put content out, put posts out, and it's a really easy way to kind of start building your business step by step. As I'm sure you're all aware, like Twitter is just like amazing for theatre, through like, and there's loads of stuff on there like OV Connect and stuff like that. So that's like an initial thing I'd look at. And then a website's really great as well, because you'll be asked for that a lot in funding apps, along with your mission statement, which we spoke about earlier on. Like a website and a mission statement are two things that come up a lot on funding applications. And also just like making documents of all your previous experience as well, because that will really benefit you as well. And they're kind of like the core things I would say you need to do before you start applying to things, because everything will be like, what's your social media handles? What's your mission statement? What's your previous experience? What work do you create? So I think once you have all established that, and you have gone through that and have these packs, and you understand what your responsibilities are, you can start tackling funding opportunities and stuff like that. But there's no hard or fast rule, but I just think those things are really beneficial to do at first, because when you start doing funding apps, you'll realize that you have to do it all anyway. So that would be my advice to kick things off with. Someone's still in the waiting room. Let me try and message Sue whilst I answer the next question. Thanks. If you're currently the only core member of your company as a director, would you recommend waiting until you have assembled a team together, at the very least a producer, to register your company properly, or does it matter at all? The answer is it doesn't matter at all. A company can consist of one member. So Chalkline was me for 18 months. I was the only director, which basically just means that legally you have every single responsibility. Like that's ultimately what it means if in terms of talking about registering as a legal entity. And you can operate that way and have a company that's just you as the director, but if you do want to bring other people in, then you can do that later on as well. So I was registered for 18 months, and then it's as simple as literally just filing a form online, and you can add people to your company. So that's something you can do at a later date if you're not quite set on who you want to bring in yet. It's really up to you. A big piece of advice that someone once gave is why would you want to set up a theatre company if it's just you as an individual, when you can operate as a sole trader? So your business could just be under your name, rather than registering as a company limited by guarantee. You can register your directing name or your writing name and then still employ people, because obviously you can apply for funding grants as an individual. So I think it's just weighing up whether you actually want to have a theatre company, which is like a collective of people that work together, or if you do want to operate as a sole trader, then that's probably the best business model to go down, would be my advice on that. Micro-entity accounts, what's the value range of that? Great question. Off the top of my head, I think it's anything that doesn't turn over a profit of over 100k or something like that.
I think it's actually about 600.
Oh, is it? Oh, 600. Yeah.
Big.
Yeah. It's companies in the world. So it's a really large amount. So Yeah, I mean, we've turned over nowhere near that. So, and I think it measures it in what your annual turnover is. So microentity accounts will probably exist for most of us for quite a while. Hello again, Sam. My new company is also created for working class artists. Oh, great. I've produced and directed two Northern Working Class plays at the Jack. I'd love to. At the end I'll hand out my email address to people, and if people want to get in touch and chat further, then that's absolutely fine. Next question. Is it worth setting up a company for the very first show, or is it better to do it as a freelancer? Again, I would say that that's ultimately your choice. You can do the show under a company name, but that company name doesn't have to legally be registered. Obviously, as long as no one else has that company name and you're not stealing someone like a company name that has been registered. So if you want to create a company and put the show on under a company name as freelancers, then you can do that. And I think, again, it the advice I would give is it's just like, do you want to be a theatre company, or do you want to put on shows under your name, kind of thing? And I think it's just weighing up which you want to do. Is there public liability insurance policies geared for theatre companies? Yes, there are. And there are websites where you can get all of these insurances. So we went through Equity, and Equity pointed us in the direction of certain websites. And then we found them, and we kind of looked around at other companies. I can't remember who we use off the top of my head. But if I remember, I'll post it in the chat later. But yes, you can look through places like Equity to find insurance for theatre companies. And for example, like if you only wanted to get insurance for like a festival, so for like a 2 week festival, I think it costs something like £100. And then obviously the bigger the projects, or if you get it for the whole year, the prices vary. Another question. So would you wait until a project is fully funded before actually putting it into motion? Yes, unless you are operating on a profit share and people are happy to go in under that knowledge, and people are happy to commit to that project with it. Obviously, a profit share is not what anyone wants to be doing. So my advice would be like, yes, wait until the project is fully funded. And I always say that as well, because I genuinely believe it will improve the quality of the project and the work that you produce. Yes, but that doesn't mean though that there, as a theatre company, you can't be like coming up with stuff that you want to create. Or like having discussions between you and the people that are working on the show, or like reading drafts of scripts and stuff like that. That, you know, those conversations don't have to stop. But and something I would highly recommend is before like necessarily jumping at wanting to put a production on, you can apply for funding for R&D, research and development for plays, where you apply for funding for like, you know, anywhere from like 1 to 3 weeks normally people do. And it's literally just gives you the time to get in a room with people paid and develop the piece that you're working on, or develop any ideas you have. And R&D funding tends to be more accessible than funding for shows, from what I've heard through other people applying as well. So research and development is stuff that you can always aim to be doing. So it doesn't always have to feel like you need to wait until a project. I would also always remember that you can be doing research and development and stuff like that. Great. So someone has said that they've produced and directed 2 or 3 week runs at the Jack and the White Bear, Baron's Court. How do I get to the next stage, please? Say small stage touring. Yeah, great question. Touring is a really interesting one. And we always kind of look for the theatres where we feel like the show will sell. And this requires a bit of digging. So understanding venues' demographics and the people that go to their theatres and the people that attend your shows, and making a link. So just for people out there, like the first thing you need to engage with touring venues is a tour pack. And in that tour pack, you list like what the show, the kind of blurb and what the show's about. You'll probably have a page where you have any press quotes that you have for the show, or industry quotes or audience quotes. I would then highly recommend having a page which is like your USP. So it's like your audience. What is the audience of that show? And if that show has been staged, like, for example, this person has done 3-week runs at the White Bear, I would list the figures that you bought in for audience there. So how successful was that show in terms of numbers? And why would those numbers appeal to the targeted audience that you had at the White Bear at somewhere like the Alphabet in Newcastle? Like, it's about saying to the theatre that my show really works in your venue and with your programming. And that's the best thing you can do, is build this tour pack that has all of this information that they can look at in one place. Ideally, you'll have a recorded version of the show as well, which they can watch, because lots of people are unable to travel. So even if it's a really, you know, like even if you have to record it on your phone or like a really cheap video camera, like it was really worth always recording your material for trying to engage with tour booking. And the problem is you will get people that will just say no, because, you know, some venues, they will decide that all of their shows in that season will tackle like one theme or engage with a certain kind of audience or demographic. And if your work doesn't fall into appealing to that programming model, then obviously they're not going to program a period drama when they're doing a season of like grime musicals. So I think it's just also like being aware of what people are programming. Another piece of advice is that venues program way more in advance than you would think. So most people were like, well, before all this, most people had already nearly been programmed up until the end of summer next year, before the lockdown and everything started. So it's about knowing that if you do a show in, say, February this year, the likelihood is that probably won't tour until summer next year, maybe even autumn next year. So if you are contacting venues in February going, we're trying to do a winter tour, people will just reply and just say, sorry, we're booked up, because they will be booked up. So I think it's just always like measuring, giving yourself a time frame in which you can be considered as well. And it's a lot of trial and error. Some places won't reply to you on one show, and then the next show you do, they get back to you, and the ones that replied last time don't. It's just keeping active, keep emailing. And I always say try and find a personal email if you can, which can be a lot of digging as well. Like, look up on the theatre's websites who the programmers are in that venue, and then try and find their personal emails. And a great way to cheat this is, for example, if you see an email on the website where it says like sam.edmonds@thealbany.com, if you then find someone's name that is Sarah Gillingham, you know that their email address is going to be sarah.gillingham@thealbany.com. And so that's like a little thing that you can look out for as well. But yeah, that would be my advice for touring. The tour packet is really essential. Great. Oh yeah, someone's posted a link to explain what microentity is more. That's great. Another question. With the new diorama, if you have questions, keep posting them in the chat, because the video seems to be on and off on certain people's Wi-Fi. With the new diorama, when they talk about opportunities with them, they say you need to be a company. Does this mean a set company of actors like Faction Theatre, for example? Sorry, Elizabeth's just raised a point. Production photos, of course, are great to put in your tour packs as well and send out to the venues. But I think if you can get a film at the time, then that's great. But production photos is like the cheaper alternative, although the rates for that can be quite high as well. So in terms of the new diorama, so one thing that is really important is like knowing your theatre and what they do. So like Elizabeth has said, the new diorama is a theatre that puts on work by theatre companies. Whereas somewhere like the Bush Theatre, for example, puts on work by playwrights. So when you are looking at getting your work programmed, it's really important to look at what that theatre programs. Is that a theatre of new writing? Is it a theatre that loves doing classics? Are they a theatre that says to you that they only put work on that's devised? And all of these theatres will have it on their website and what they do. And to answer this question in particular, do you need to be a company? The answer is yes, but that doesn't mean that you need to be a legal entity. It just means that you need to exist as a collective that work under that one name. It is my knowledge of the new diorama and their programming. And also, like it's really important to remember that emerging artists doesn't mean age. To everyone applying for these things, emerging artists literally is like where you are at in your career. And sometimes I think like the word emerging can almost put people off applying because it feels like it's a young thing. But like in emerging groups that I've been in, there's people of all ages, which is really important to bear in mind. Jamil said that trailers and videos are great. Yeah, so what we always do as a company is when we have a recorded performance, we then just take clips from it and make a trailer. And that's would be my advice for the cheapest way to do a trailer. Because that way, you know, a programmer will engage with your work for 2 minutes maybe than rather sit down and watch the whole hour production. So I wouldn't worry too much about paying extortionate monies to get a trailer. Like as long as you've got something like Windows Movie Maker, you can just kind of fade in and out of clips that show the range of the show, which is a nice thing to have. And it also the file size means that you can send it over to people really quickly and easily as well. Okay, the next question that's in is, with trying to source funding to an R&D, a project before aiming to get it staged, are there specific streams or opportunities that would be good to be aware of, or similar A/commissions avenue? Again, ultimately, like, ACE and stuff, they are the avenues to go down. But the great thing about R&Ds is loads of theatres release R&D opportunities, which you can apply for through applications. I talk a lot about London, by the way, because that's my best knowledge of the theatre scene. But like somewhere like Arts Depot, they do residencies throughout the whole year, where you can apply for a 4-day residency, you can apply for a 2-week residency. And they, most of the time, these places will even offer a couple of £100 as a commission as well. So in terms of trying to source funding for an R&D, like look out for these little mini commissions, and stuff like that, because theatres are putting them out there quite a lot. And obviously they're highly competitive, but the great thing about one of these R&Ds, if you do get one, is is I don't, those of you aware of Arts Council, is like when you submit your budgets, you can, you talk about your income, your outcome, and your supporting kind. And supporting kind is basically what people are giving you for free towards your project that you can categorize with a figure. So if I gave you a week of free rehearsal space, how much would you have actually had to have paid for that space if I didn't give it to you for free? And you can class that as income, which really benefits funding applications. So even if you're trying to do an R&D and you're struggling for like sourcing funding from people, just try and get like some free rehearsal space, some free performance space, and build up these little things with theatres. Because you're, I mean, the two most expensive things always are our actors and a room. So if you can cut the cost of the room, and then you just have your actors and your creatives to pay for, sourcing funding becomes a lot easier because you're slowly taking out expenditure. But yeah, in terms of like actual organizations for funding pools, again, yes, like ACE is your big one. And there are foundations, like I know in London there's I think it's pronounced the Cockney Foundation, or the it's not quite spelt Cockney, but that's the foundation that gets launched. There's like a funding bid you can do twice a year on that. There's things like the Time to Stare bursary, where you can actually get, you apply for it, and you, if you get it, then you go and stay in like the Woodlands in this house that they have and stuff like that. And there's lots of like little small pots of money like that around, which, you know, just spending a couple of hours Google searching, you'll find a lot. Yeah, so that would be my advice for extra kind of sources for R&D funding. The next question is, what have you found the steepest learning curves in terms of administration skills? Yeah, I mean, the hardest thing about all of this is writing funding applications. And then once you've got the funding application in terms of admin, it's writing up contracts, it's writing up budgets, it's liaising with all these people. That's why I always say, like, don't jump into like running a business and doing these big projects like straight away, because there is a lot of admin and stuff that goes with it. Like, you know, especially as a charity, you'll have to write your equal opportunities policies, your governing document. You might even have to write your safeguarding policy if you work with children. So there is in terms of like administrative skills, I mean, you end up picking up a lot of skills that you never thought you would, in terms of writing policies and funding bids and contracts. And you just get better at them as time goes on. There's no answer to how do you get great at them straight away. You do just get better at it all as you go along. The next question, how did you get funding to run workshops, and how did you approach the community when working with them? Yeah, great. So the first lot of workshops we did, we knew we wanted to engage with working class artists, and we were like, the hardest way of doing that is, obviously, you need a room where everyone can come to, and you need and to reach out to people. So what we did is, we were like, in order to do this successfully the first time, let's contact people that already do a similar thing and ask if they'll work in association with us. So with Common, we emailed Common and we said, we want to do all this and provide these skills to people. Would you be happy to support us and share these workshops across your network, so that it can reach the like massive audience base you have for working class artists already? And we were very fortunate that they said yes. So in terms of engaging with the community, we bought in an organization that was already doing that. And then on top of that, we just like found Twitter groups and Facebook groups for like working class producers or working class theater makers, and just started posting in them and sharing information about our workshops, and community centers. Like, if you know, they're a great source to go to, or places of like schools and education, depending on what your workshops are. Like, they're like free places that are easy to engage with people in that local area if they fit in with your workshops. In terms of funding, we applied for funding, but because we'd managed to get Common on board, it meant that we were able to get access to free space to run the workshops, and we didn't need to pay for marketing because they already had a wide engagement. So we only actually needed to fundraise, I think it was a couple of £100, because we were paying people £50 for an hour workshop to come in and talk to people. And you can do that without Arts Council, really easily. You know, and I always think, like, if you're going out and working within a community that is disenfranchised and unrepresented, like, you don't want to be charging people to do it. So as I would say, like, my biggest advice on how to get these workshops up and running is like I said, get all of that support in kind in place, so that all you're left with is paying someone, you know, £50 an hour for a workshop, which is normally like a standard rate. Or if it's like a kind of physical workshop or something, it might be stretched closer to £100. But yeah, like, and you can put funding bids into Arts Council England that just are for workshops. They don't have to be anything to do with shows. So, you know, and you can submit a funding bid for £1,000 if you like. And so there's all, and these foundations as well. Like, I think it's really important to remember that when you're kind of creating your work and stuff, like, the funding pools are there for all arts engagement, not just making theatre shows. So if you are really interested in the workshops, then you can just literally keep applying for funding for them as well. Yeah. So another question, what's your year like in terms of admin meetings, overview, reflection, i.e. how much of your time and energy to be on it? Yeah, good question. That's changed over the course of 3 years. And I think it will continue to change. Over the course of 3 years, we really grew. So at first, it was almost like a hobby, something I was really passionate about, but you know, never quite knew what it meant to be running a theatre company as a business or anything. And then when we started to get to a position where we were putting on more than one performance a year, that was when it started to get to a point where I was like, well, in order to do this, you know, you yourself commit more time, which is why I always say it's so important to make sure you get funding before a project, because it means that you have money as yourself to make all these projects happen, meaning that you don't have to try and get as much freelance work if you're already bringing in money for yourself to do your work. But it is a lot of juggling. Like, I worked a full I'm a working class artist. Like, I was working a full-time job whilst running our company for 2 out of the 3 years, and it was basically every moment of time off I got, I'd work on the company, and I'd use my holiday from work to do the projects for the company. So if you're passionate enough, like, I'm adamant you can find a way to do it. But then it's important, like, as you're growing, you start then realizing, well, I don't want to be doing that anymore. I want to grow with the company. So then you start, like I say, applying for funding for organizational development, where you can approach Arts Council and apply for money to literally develop your organization, which pays for you to be sat in a room with your company members, doing like stuff like SWOT analysis, where you analyze your work and and talk about it, and you start putting in like an organizational model on top of your creative model. So you've got your creative model, like you can all create your shows and you know how it works in the room, but then you start to develop your organizational model, and you, and there are funding pools for that out there. And you can even apply through stuff as individuals for organizational development as well. Like, you know, like the Gerwood Foundation and stuff like that. There's funding pools that are out there for that kind of development for individuals. So yeah, I mean, you know, depending on your circumstances, depends on the flexibility you have to throw into your company. The reason that there's now two people running my company is we're at a point now where it is too much for myself. Like running projects as well as doing all the admin and outreach as one person just became a lot. And I've been collaborating with someone on every single show, and they'd always helped me out without like ever asking and stuff. And so we then decided, well, as the company's growing, the team grew. So I think, yeah, I think at first, like I always say it gets busy when there's a project, and then when there's not a project is the time where it's less busy. So I just, yeah, I think it just grows over time. Yeah, basically. Another question is, do you think it's possible to be a director and a producer for your company? Or is that too much for one person? I do think it's possible. I do both. I direct and produce every show that we do. Yes, it is a lot. You know, there are times where you've got producing duties that you need to do, but you've found yourself, you're in the rehearsal room and you know that there are emails that need to be sent off and stuff. So it is a lot, and I think it all comes down to time management. So something that we start doing now is every time we get a project confirmed, we're like, let's build our press pack, let's build all of this material that needs to be sent out in like 4 months' time before we get anywhere near the rehearsal process. So that when the rehearsal process comes, you can put your director hat on, because you've just spent all the beforehand time prepping a lot of the producing stuff. And it is a struggle. But if that's something you want to do, then I do think it's achievable. Yeah, I've done it myself and I really enjoy it. It doesn't mean you kind of never switch off outside of the rehearsal room, but it's definitely something you can do. Where is a good resource to find budget templates? Good question. I wouldn't be able to point you in the direction of anything specific. I suppose places like Stage One again will have budget templates, and if anyone knows of any links to any budget templates, then please do share. But I think in terms of I could really quickly just run through like what an overall budget might look like. So like in terms of your budget, like I mean, income's pretty self-explanatory. Like your income is all the money that you think you're going to get from like foundations you've applied to, arts council you've applied to, crowdfunders, etc. And then, like I said, supporting kind is also something to consider for budget templates. But in terms of your expenditure, like your main kind of expenses are all of your artist expenses. You know, then rehearsal expenses. So, and performance expenses. And I split those two up. So rehearsal expenses will be like rehearsal room, like if you decide you want all your set and props in the room, how, you know, you've got, how are you going to get them there? So you start thinking about van hire and how you're going to get stuff to and from the rehearsal room. Then like obviously you've got all your props, set and costume budgets and funding for that. You know, and you're always going to encounter costs in the rehearsal room that you didn't expect. So The best piece of advice you could ever be given is have a contingency in your budget when you're starting out. Start off at 10%. And then if you feel more confident with how you manage your budget as you go on, drop down to 5%. And a contingency is basically just there for all these unexpected costs. Like, for example, we toured once, parked a van somewhere we shouldn't have, and we got a parking bill. You know, just small things like that. And it happens to everyone. But yeah, in terms of a good resource to find budget templates, I don't have a particular link to point you to. But if I do, maybe I can pass it on to Sue. And I think she has all your email addresses, so she could send it out afterwards. So I'll look into that for you. Another question. There are so many companies out there. Unless your mission is really, really specific, is it more financially responsible to pitch your ideas to existing companies for collaborations? Could that also be better in terms of publicity? Yeah, great question. I guess if they're the people you want to work with, then yeah. But if they're not, I would say no. And again, it brings me back to, if there's a project you want to do as an individual, I just do it under your name at first. If you don't want to form a theatre company, and in terms of publicity, I think publicity is quite a funny thing, because I mean it is like a really crazy market trying to sell your show anyway, and with these big names like. I think, you know, automatically, like, it is going to bring in audience to your work and stuff if you collaborate with a large company. And that, you know, and it's hard to get hold of those opportunities if that's what you're seeking. But in terms of like, will you get publicity as an emerging company? My answer would be yes. It's just being really specific about like how you target your audience and build that audience. So for example, when we did our first show, of course, like, loads of it was like, let's just get all of our family and friends in, it's two shows, let's sell it out. But then, like, from that you then start to think, well, how can you start building audiences for next time? So how do you like keep content going whilst you're creating a show that engages people? So I always say, like, talking about budgets again, we always put together a marketing budget where we say we're going to run like advertisements through Facebook is something that we always do, and Instagram. And on there, you can be really specific about who you target. And you can also be specific about the interests of those people and location of those people. And if your post isn't engaging in any activity, even though you said you're going to spend £70 on that advert, you can cancel it after £2 and they won't charge you anymore. So you, there's like ways that you can see how that engagement is working. And then a lot of it's like, you know, we did a show about like activism and cuts to the NHS. So we emailed like loads of universities and student nurses and all this kind of stuff, and offered them ticket deals and stuff like that. And yeah, I really do think in terms of publicity, like, it's just about putting yourself out there. I don't necessarily think it's impossible to engage with new audiences on your first show and stuff. I mean, it obviously gets easier the more people recognize your work, but I just think it's about really being really specific in the targeting of the audience and stuff. So I'd say, like, if you're looking to work with an existing company because you want to, then great. But I wouldn't be fearful of trying to do it yourself. It just might be more of a uphill battle at first, that will get easier over time. Like, you know, our first Edinburgh Fringe show, we had like 9 people turn up to the show, or like 3 people at first, because it's such a saturated market. But you know, the more you put yourself out there, the easier it gets, and the more you find ways of bringing in audience members you didn't think would actually come. What advice would you give yourself when starting your theatre company, and what is your favourite thing about having your theatre company? What advice would I give myself? Probably to enjoy it all a bit more. I think it can be quite daunting at first, and you can get caught up in, oh, only 20 people came to see my first show and stuff like that after all the hard work you put in. But I think, like, I didn't realize at the time, like, how great, when you've never even put on a show before, like getting something like 18 to 20 people in to see it is. And I think, like, I would just say, like, it's about, well, the advice I give myself is just have more fun with it, and don't compare yourself to other theatre companies. Don't compare yourself to what you see online. Like, you know, people can tweet saying, oh, tickets are selling really fast, da 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 da. And in reality, that might not be true, as some of you might have seen with some of the Edinburgh Fringe stuff that happened last year. So yeah, I think it's like, have fun in what you're doing, and don't really worry about others, and realize that, you know, it can be a long journey. And my favorite thing about having a theatre company, well, my favorite thing is the outreach we do at the minute. I kind of lead the outreach work, and I just love, like, meeting new people and giving back to, like, communities and stuff like that. And so that's a real passion of mine. And, like, I you know, sometimes get more out of talking to 60 people in a room than I do watching my show back sometimes. So yeah, that's probably my favorite thing. It's like being creative with people that you want to work with, and helping others is something that I love doing through our company. Next question is, as starting a company in London, what do you think is a good amount of work to have developed previously to be considered a valid portfolio for applying along more official lines of funding / touring, etc.? Would you recommend creating as much small-scale working venues like theatre pubs, etc., as possible? This is a really good question, because one thing, I know this workshop isn't really about ACE, but I'll just quickly talk about it, is like, when applying for funding through ACE, there's a big section of your application where they want to see evidence of, like, people that are managing this project and their previous experience of managing projects. So if you're going to Arts Council and you're asking for 55,000, like, and you've never managed a budget before, you know, it's highly unlikely that they will entrust you with that £55,000. So this question that's come in is really valid, because I would always say that when approaching a funding bid, go small first. When approaching your first show, go small first. Because yes, it builds up your portfolio, which then, like I've said, you can then demonstrate, well, we did a show with a budget of £8,000. It went really well. We're now asking for £15,000. So it's not that much different to what we had before. And, you know, organizations that provide funding and stuff are far more likely to offer money to someone that shows evidence that they have managed budgets before. And that doesn't mean that you need to have been funded before to demonstrate budget management. Like, if you do a crowdfunder and you get £5,000 and then you put a show on with that £5,000, you know, you're demonstrating not only that you've got the skill to manage a budget, but you had the skill to fundraise yourself. And so, yeah, my advice would be to build up from small scale upwards, just because I think, in terms of, like, being a theatre company starting out and creating work, there's a lot that happens and comes with it. And starting small, I think you will slowly realise, like, how big small can actually feel. like putting on a show in a 50-seater for quite a few nights, it is quite a big task in itself when you're starting out. So my recommendation for your own kind of safety and sanity and enjoyment would be to start small and build from there. But that doesn't mean you can't build quickly. It doesn't mean that you have to put shows on in theatre pubs for 10 years. I would recommend starting small and building up that portfolio. Yes, your theatre company website lists a designer as well as yourself and your co-artist director. Could you talk a bit about what role they play in the company? Is it mainly show-based? Yeah, so our company does consist of three members. Two of us are directors of the company, and as this has been pointed out, we have a designer as well, Becca. She does operate on a show basis. So she is like our resident designer, and our kind of thing with her is she's not interested in producing. She's not really interested in running a theatre company. Like she does costume and set design. So when we get a project, we then go, Becca, we've got work for you. We've got a project, and she comes in and does the project. However, recently, Becca, we said to her, like, you know, would you be interested in maybe taking on like a slightly more developed role in the fact that you help produce like marketing content? So like, would you be interested in designing posters and stuff for shows, or and like maybe helping design the website and stuff? And so we have a relationship now where when we get small pots of money, we will pay Becca to like look after the website or create our posters and stuff for us. And that's really great because it means that in our company, we have someone that on every project we can turn to and build our marketing content and design our shows. So that's her role. It's mainly show based, but over the course of the year, she's started to now take on a kind of more marketing based role as well. Next question is, what advice would you give about being collaboratively involved in a company with multiple individuals involved? What would you do if members are being treated unequally / not being involved in decision making? This is an interesting question, because I think, like I say, like when you enter into running a theatre company and you are a legal entity, that's when this situation can become quite stressful, because if you've got projects on and stuff and people aren't pulling their weight, and especially outside, like if your company accounts are due for that year, and the other individuals in your group aren't helping you to put together your accounts and stuff like that, it is really difficult. And that's why, like, I would really recommend like making sure that you're with the right group of people, and if you're not, then like having that conversation as soon as possible and addressing the issues that are coming up as soon as possible, and reiterating the fact that it's a business ultimately, in terms of if this is happening when you're a theatre company. And then like if members are being treated unequally and not being involved in decision making, I just think, again, my advice would just be to address it. Just keep addressing it. And I think what's really important is like what we do now, due to this pandemic, which has made us realize like, why did we never do it before, is like every 2 or 3 weeks we just sit down and we say, are you still enjoying doing this? Like, you know, have I done anything to annoy you? Da, da, da. And just like really looking after each other's well-being as well. That would be my advice in terms of that. Cool, another couple of questions. We've got, if you produce slash direct as an individual, can you still apply for the various grants you have mentioned? Yes, you can. As an individual, you can apply for the majority of all these grants. Obviously, you wouldn't be able to apply for any charitable grants because you can't register you're an individual as a charity. But yeah, you can apply for all of these grants unless they state that it's for a theatre company and you have to have a theatre company name. But I haven't come across that as such. Yeah, you, as far as I'm aware, you can still apply for all the grants. You just might have to say within it, like, because you would be producing the show, you just have to give it an example of shows that you've produced as an individual. So, you know how before I was saying, like, you have to demonstrate how your company has done project managing. You just have to demonstrate how you've done project managing would be the only difference. And also a thing just to, like, quickly throw out there to everyone is that when you set up your organization, obviously you will then set up a bank account in that name, because when you're applying for stuff like ACE funding, they won't fund an organization unless that organization has a bank account under the same name as the company. Is just something to put out there for those that are considering setting one up, is you will have to also set up a business bank account under the same name. Otherwise you straight away fall through funding criteria. Yeah, just to put that out there. Next question is, do you know how hard it is to break even on a small production, as you've mentioned? Something like 70 to 90 minutes long with three actors. What type of venue could offer that? My impression is that pub theatres are environments where it's hard to break even, so you must rely on funding. Yeah, I mean, breaking even, it is very difficult. Like, for example, like, there are some pub theatres that won't offer the guarantee, which I said. So, for example, when we did our first three-week run in London, when we thought we were ready, we did ours at the Hope Theatre in Islington. And they do have a guarantee for their venue, but they don't take it out. They don't take it from you until you get your box office come in. So as long as you have, like, got the money to pay all your creatives, then the guarantee comes out of the box office. But in terms of other venues, they will ask for guarantees up front. Some of them do. But yeah, how hard is it to break even? The answer is really difficult, because if you're paying everyone equity minimum, you know, from director, designer, producer, actors, stage manager, however many creators you have, then it is really difficult without funding, because if you're paying everyone like the ITC minimum rate, which is £483 a week, and you're doing three actors are doing like a week long shows already, that's like over £2,000 that you should be paying them, which obviously on box office, if you're only charging £10 a ticket in a 50 seater, you know, you'd need to sell out. So it is really difficult without funding in that regard. However, like I've said before, in terms of, like, getting support and kind and stuff, and keeping it small production and small budget, if you don't get the funding, then, like, the best case scenario is that you enter into a production just having to pay the actors, and at the rest of the cost you've managed to cover yourself, like, with support and kind. In that regards, you might be able to break even, where you just have to pay the creatives. But then again, like, you still really have to push ticket sales quite hard. Yeah, unfortunately, is just the risk. Yeah. When you say small scale work, do you recommend writing your own work, working with writers, or getting licenses for a play? What do you recommend is the best for getting audiences and building up the theatre company? I'd say the answer to that question really comes down to artistically what you want to do. So originally I thought I was going to be a playwright. I wrote a play. I really didn't enjoy it. So now we bring in other playwrights. And we've never been interested in staging already published plays. We've always been interested in new writing, which, like you say, that then brings the difficulty of how do you get audiences to engage with new writing. And whereas if you do an established play, then at least people might recognize the material. But yeah, I would just say that that's a kind of artistic decision on your part. Like you can do any of those things as long as you have a strong marketing campaign. I reckon I could try and push to sell new writing under my company as good as I could like Romeo and Juliet, as long as my marketing campaign was good enough. And I think there's a real buzz for new writing and new work and stuff. So I wouldn't be put off by the fact that your first work, like, it will be easier to sell if it's Romeo and Juliet, because actually, you know, these Shakespeare plays or these classics, they've been done by the big theatres. Whereas at least with new writing and your own work, you're engaging people in stuff that they might never have seen before. So yeah, I'd say go with your artistic vision on that one. Yeah, when setting up a bank account for a company that chooses to work as an individual, do you register it under your personal name or the name of the theatre company, please? So I would just put, so if you're acting as a self-employed, like sole trader, I would just have the bank account set up under the same name as that. And like what's really good about that is if you did have that bank account separate to your own finances, is when it comes to doing your accounts, it's just all separated for you already. And like a piece of advice I'll throw out there from having the stress of doing our first company accounts last year is that when we started operating, I did all the finances out of my personal account, because it took forever for us to set up a business account. I then didn't file any of that under my self-assessment because I was like, well, that's the company's dealings, it's not mine. And then eventually came to doing my company accounts, and luckily I could file all of those things under the company, but I then had to track them all and log them through the company's account, which became a really complicated process. So a big piece of advice is, like, if you are deciding to operate under an individual or a company, is try and keep your personal finances and those finances in two separate accounts as quickly as you can, because it will save you a lot of stress in the long run. Is paying less than the EITC minimum an option to you? I.e., the King's Head have a deal with Equity, I believe, where they could pay performers £275 for 20 hours a week. Is that the kind of thing, a valid route, or would you be looked at poorly? I don't think you'd be looked at poorly at all. Like, the £275 is the Equity minimum fringe rate that someone should be paid a week. Or for 20 hours, like you say, yeah, the five rehearsals or what it is. And I think the Hope Theatre even have an agreement where you pay someone £25 every 3 hours they work or something like that. And then there's like holiday pay on top of that. So no, you wouldn't be frowned upon £275 a week. It is Equity fringe rates. And I would personally advise that should be the minimum that you try and fundraise to pay people. Obviously aim for ITC minimum, because that's like a comfortable living wage. But I would say don't go below Equity rates, because you wouldn't, I just always think if you wouldn't want to work for that money, then other people shouldn't either. But yeah, £275 is Equity fringe rates. If that's what you wanted to operate on, people wouldn't frown upon you, especially as an emerging company. Like, you know, you're not a large institution. You're just setting out. So if you're on your first production paying people £275 a week, then hats off to you. That's great. That's really great. Yeah, Hope pay minimum wage £15 now for three. Yeah, they do. I mean, that it. So when we did ours, so part of our contract with the Hope is that we had to sign saying that we would at least achieve this contract, this equity contract of I think it was £25 per 3 hours when we did ours. So that's absolutely fine if that's the equity agreement and your actors and everyone is happy to work for that and can afford to work for that, and that's absolutely fine. What's this for HMRC? Is that two tax returns, personal and company, or one big one? So it'd be two. I do my personal as a freelancer self assessment, and then I do my so it's called corporation tax, and then company accounts is what it's called. So you have to file your corporation tax and your company accounts when you're a legal entity. And they're fairly straightforward, actually. I'd say in some ways they're slightly more straightforward than your self-assessment once you know what you're doing. I suppose if you were to register yourself for self-assessment under your performer name and personal name, or however you decide to do it to manage the two accounts, I suppose, again, yes, I would presume that you would have to do the two tax returns if you did that. However, I'm not sure of anyone that has done that, to be honest. I would presume it would be two. As far as profit share for the whole company, is that a no-go, really? Yes, it would be like the answer that in the ideal world, but you know, if you have people that can afford to do it and have the passion to do it and they want to do it, like, you know, no one's going to frown upon you. I don't think I'd put, I'm at a point where I would feel strange putting out a profit share call. But like when we were starting out, our first show was operated on profit share because we were all like just really passionate about creating our first piece of theatre and going for it and sharing the financial risk. And we're fortunate to be in a position to do it. I wouldn't say it's something to aim to do. But if you have people that will do it with you, if it's just like, say, if it's three of you in the company, the three of you in the show, and you just want to do your first show and you can afford to do it, then by all means, then yeah, definitely. But I just think in terms of like putting in a, you know, a business model and pushing forward, like I would always aim to achieve equity minimum rates. Thank you, everyone.